William Morrow and Harper Audio present Shadows of Pecan Hollow, a novel by Caroline Frost, performed by Alex McKenna. Prologue. Round Top, Texas, 1976. The young woman awoke to the sound of scissors. She blinked the haze out of her eyes, rolled over the tangled sheets to greet him. She was 19 or so, but the crease between her brows and the wear on her skin hinted at a life not lived but endured. He sat naked beneath the window, a stack of newspapers beside him, cutting. The light dripped down his slick black hair and pooled on his shoulders, the tops of his knees, but his face, which was bent toward his work, was only shadow. "Morning," she said, her voice dry as sand. She groped the nightstand for something wet and drank the rest of a warm Dr. Pepper from who knows when. "What's that? Did they see us?" He continued to pump the scissors, long and heavy ones with black handles, and sniffed.
"You should have put ice on that," he said.
She cupped her cheek, which was hot and swollen as a late summer plum. If she flicked it, she thought, it would split from eye to ear.
"It doesn't hurt," she said.
"Well, it should," he said. "The fuck is wrong with you?"
He'd given the bruise to her yesterday, when she had rushed the getaway and stalled out, a sucker punch to the side of the head. He arranged the cut pieces in front of him, flipped them over, and brushed glue along the backs. The fumes snaked across the room to her, a smell she had always liked. As he worked, a gold medallion necklace, one he'd lifted off a guy passed out behind a club, swung and tapped against his chest.
"If they got eyes on us, we should take off, hang out in Louisiana for a bit," she said.
He paid her no mind. He was always tempting the law, and the day would come he'd get them both locked up. This life was mean. The late nights, the constant running, and the sickening fear of getting caught. It was too mean, even for her, but she hadn't figured out a way to lose the life and keep the man. She sat up, gathered the motel sheet around her, and wrapped herself up next to him. He smelled like their violent tumble from hours ago, hadn't showered. That was a good sign. When he showered, it usually meant he was going somewhere she wasn't welcome. But he was cold this morning. She couldn't stand when he was cold. Angry? Fine. But cold she could not bear and would do anything to bring him back around. He leaned away, shrugged her off. She began to pulse behind the eyeballs, something awful rolling up inside her.
"You want to know if they saw us?" he asked.
He put aside the scissors and glued the last of the papers to a cardstock backing, then gave it to her. There was a tight arrangement of articles and a blurry picture below the headline, "Texaco Twosome Caught on Camera." In the image, two masked figures are driving away in a Mustang. One drags his leg out the open passenger door. The driver faces forward, her eyes reflected in the rearview mirror, her dark hair whipping behind her.
"They saw us, but they'll remember you."
She wanted to end it all right there, beg him to give up the life and settle down somewhere, change their names, get a dog. They could build something, maybe, instead of tearing off with other people's things. It didn't matter what she wanted, though. He peeled the sheet away from her, snapped it up in the air, and lay it over the floor beneath the window. Her skin goosed at the sudden cold. The sun bounced off the blade of the open scissors in front of her. With two quick curls of his fingers, he gestured for her to hand them over. She picked them up and noted the heft in her palm, the metal smell.
"Kneel down," he said, and she lowered herself at his feet.
He gestured again, reaching out.
She put the handle in his palm, but didn't let go of the blades. He yanked them out of her grasp and gathered her long hair in his hands. Burying his face into it, he inhaled. Then he sheared the hair away from her scalp, one section at a time. Part 1. Chapter 1. Pecan Hollow, Texas, 1990. Cicadas rattled the pecan trees over the Listing Ranch house where Kit Walker assessed her opponent, a mass of blackberry brambles. Their vicious tendrils snaked around the back porch, pried up floorboards, and wove between balusters, rendering the back door, now fully obscured by the fearsome thicket, defunct. She sluiced the sweat off her arms and rubbed her palms down the front of her jeans. She could have done this in January, when the scarlet canes had lost their leaves and the crowns would be easy to spot and remove by the fibrous roots. In January, there was no nuclear sun, no cloying humid air thick with the smells of manure and hot grass. January would have been better. Although Kit was not one to brood, today a memory perched on her shoulder, taunting and elusive, a spectral crow that flapped out of sight each time she turned her head. It was a far-off thing, long forgotten, dismissed, or buried. Kit had survived by keeping a keen and suspicious eye on the present. Planning was pointless, regret even more so. No patience for mystery, she dealt in concretes. Could she touch it, swing it, scrub it, crush it? Could she put it in her mouth and taste it? Track it down and skin it? Unless it was in her hands or on her back, unless it had a color or made a sound, she wanted no part. She pulled a few luscious black fruits clustered on the vine and ate them, juicy, sweet, and staining. Compact and mule strong, her jaw-length hair chopped in a careless arc around her face, Kit looked like an Aztec warrior. Her cheekbones high and sharp, narrow eyes that cut left and right, always scanning. Her skin was an earthy tapestry of marks. Burns and scrapes of wet red if they were fresh, pale pink and cruddy with scab if they were healing. Nicks on all her knuckles, a crooked scar under her eye, like a wink. She plucked the machete from the soft pile of dirt into which she'd plunged it and began to hack. A pair of titbirds darted from their hidden nest, but she carried on. As she ran her blade, choppily at first, then in a long X formation, her mind went clear. The machete an extension of her arms, she sank into the feeling of destroying something that didn't belong. Splinters and twigs sprayed around her, clung to her t-shirt, planted themselves in the layers of her self-cut hair. The tinny clang of the phone sounded from the kitchen. She rarely got calls and resented the interruption. Let it ring, she thought and carried on, slashing doggedly. It pestered 10, 11 times before it stopped. She hacked a great hole in the brush and peeled much of it away from the wall and onto a growing pile of tinder. The finer work of detangling the vines from the balusters she'd saved for Charlie, who had more patience for little things. When she began to choke on the soupy air, wet and warm, she took one last slice, staked her machete in the ground, and walked around front for a gulp of water. She exhaled in the cool of the house, a once white clapboard two-story built imperfectly, but strong, by its first owners in the teens. The interior was shabby, but inviting, designed for guests, with wide doorways and halls, big picture windows, a dine-in kitchen that peeked into the formal dining room. Though Kit had lived there for 14 years, it still had the air of being someone else's home. She had neither the desire nor the means to make her mark on the place and had been content to live among the floral walls, fabrics, and other grandmotherly things. She doused a kitchen rag under the tap and ran it behind her neck, down her back, over her collarbone, and stood in front of a dust-heavy tabletop fan. She'd drunk 2 tall glasses of water, felt her belly swell, when the phone started up again. It was a curse, this phone, a shackle. The school had required her to include a phone number when she enrolled Charlie, years ago, and she regretted it every time they called her. She had never gotten used to the idea that people should know where you were at any moment, be able to reach you on a whim. She was about to pick it up and slam it right back into its cradle until, remembering Charlie, she picked up. She unhooked the pale blue receiver from its mount on the wall. A woman cleared her throat on the other end.
"Ms. Walker, this is Lorraine Fowler," said the principal of Charlie's school, her voice dull and detached.
Kit girded herself for whatever infraction Charlie had committed and the inconvenience it was likely to cause her. Fowler waited for a reply, a slight asthmatic whistle as she breathed.
"Ms. Walker, you're gonna wanna come down here and pick up Charlie. There's been an incident."
"An incident?" Kit asked.
"Is she okay?"
Charlie had been called down to the office before, but it was usually truancy or mouthing off to teachers. The only other time they had called it an incident was when Charlie was suspended for whispering hateful things into a classmate's ear, things which neither party would divulge. The boy had been so affected they sent him home to recover. The suspension had lasted a week, which suited Charlie just fine and had been a real hardship for Kit, as her daughter had been ornery and fickle company in the years since she started puberty.
"Oh, she's all right," Fowler said. "Just go on ahead and come down here now. We can sort out the details in my office. Okay?"
Kit looked at the clock above the stove. 9:15 a.m., and she had to be at work at 10:00.
"Shit!"
Ms. Fowler grumbled her displeasure and cleared her throat.
"We'll be seeing you real soon, then."
Kit didn't like when Charlie got in trouble. It wasn't so much the acting out, for Kit had been far worse by comparison. It was the consequences. Trouble meant scrutiny, meetings, making nice with other parents. She liked a quiet life where her business was no one's but her own. She started walking toward the door, and the phone began to ring again, with the same incessant urgency. If it was Fowler, she could wait 15 minutes until Kit got to school. As she opened the screen door, she heard the answering machine. An old, refurbished one only Charlie knew how to use. Beep and clatter into motion. Kit was too far gone to hear who had called, and too annoyed to linger and listen. Kit took a seat in the waiting room of the principal's office at Pecan Hollow Middle School, the walls around her papered with announcements and cheery art projects. It smelled like 50 years of pencil shavings and paste. She felt partly responsible for her daughter's troubles, because in the almost 14 years they had lived together in Pecan Hollow, she had never found them a place in the community. She sometimes wished she knew how to be a part of something, but it was so much easier to keep to herself. She didn't get any of it. The rules, the manners, the tacit agreements. All she could manage was the little world she had created, just her and Charlie. Principal Fowler, dressed in beige from head to shoe, her faded chestnut hair teased and sprayed into a wiggy-looking bob, opened her door and dealt a hot stare.
"Ms. Walker, you want to go and worship?"
She had a way of asking questions that sounded like commands. Kit had not, until just now, noticed the spatter of violent purple staining her arms and clothes and, she imagined, her face.
"I'd just as soon get to it," Kit said.
Principal Fowler looked like she would just as soon get to it, too. She motioned for Kit to come in. Charlie sat glowering in the corner of the cramped office, her long hair spilling over her back in coarse waves. Like her mother's, Her shoulders were set close to her ears, as if always ready to dodge a hit. She was too tall for the stool she was sitting on, knees up by her chest. Seemed not too long ago that Kit could hold her, propped on her hip. Now Charlie stood an inch taller than her mother. Kit squared herself to Fowler's desk and folded her arms. "Is someone gonna tell me what this is all about?" she said. Fowler sat down and steepled her fingers. She looked at Charlie, then back at Kit, and sighed a shallow, tired sigh.
"Ms. Walker, I called you here today because Charlie stuck a sharp pencil in her classmate's cheek. The point went clean through."
She pantomimed the pencil with her finger against her face and made a pop sound with her lips.
"Practically skewered her like a shish kebab."
"Jesus Christ," Kit said.
"Miss Walker, please,"
said Fowler, pursed and scolding.
"Language."
"Is this true, Charlie?" Kit asked. Charlie nodded without making eye contact.
"Well, that's just... why would you..."
Kit stammered, embarrassed to be caught off guard like this in front of an audience.
"Who was it that got stuck?"
"Lee Prentice, you know, Sugar Faye's girl,"
Fowler said. Lee was Sugar Faye's fifth child and only daughter, and she had been coddled her whole life like she was the last child on earth. Kit would never hear the end of it from Sugar Faye. Her first impulse was to march the girl out of there and put her somewhere she couldn't make trouble. But Charlie looked so melancholy and far away. Kit reached out to stroke her daughter's hair, but ended up squeezing the back of her neck until she jerked away. With Kit, tender feelings rarely led to tender actions.
"I didn't mean to,"
Charlie mumbled.
"It just happened."
"Well, that doesn't add up," Kit said. "What did Lee do to make you stick her?"
"Can't say, won't snitch,"
Charlie said resolutely. Kit couldn't argue with that on principle, but she also didn't think Charlie should take the fall if she wasn't the only one to blame.
"We don't know yet what could have provoked such savage action," Fowler answered.
Kit took umbrage at the word savage and gathered it was not a slip of the tongue. Fowler went on.
"I can't imagine this came out of nowhere, but Lee couldn't tell us her side of the story because, well, she had a pencil sticking out of her face. She's with Dr. Metzger being fixed up as we speak. We'll need to meet with you and Lee's folks and see if we can't put together what happened. Till then, Ms. Walker, you're gonna have to take Charlie home and keep her there till after the year-end tests. She can come back in 2 weeks or so when school is over to make up her tests, which I will proctor myself."
"She's out for the rest of school?" Kit said.
Nope, that's not going to work." "I can't have her poking holes in my students, provoked or not."
Kit gnashed a protest between her teeth. These days, any time Charlie was home alone, she'd wander off without telling Kit where she'd gone. Kit would fret until Charlie sailed through the door like she'd done nothing wrong. Fowler leaned in and lowered her voice.
"Ms. Walker, ever think maybe Charlotte needs a man in the house?"
She looked down her nose at Kit.
"I don't know what kind of home you run, but kids need discipline, especially teenage girls."
Anger boiled over Kit's chest and behind her ears and clouded up her eyes. She jutted out her chin and set her knuckles on the yellowing varnished desk. "I really don't care for your opinion on how I run my home." She swallowed a mouthful of expletives and stalked out, grabbing Charlie by the fist. In the hallway, Charlie yanked her hand away and barreled ahead of her mother and out the double doors that opened onto the parking lot. Kit let her go and leaned against a wall. Kit turned around to face the wall and stared at a bulletin board of planetary systems in gaudy glitter and neon paint. She would never be the mother who stayed up late gluing shit to colored paper, who enjoyed brushing her daughter's hair shiny, or packing little sandwiches cut just so and sealing the brown bag with a sticker. It all seemed so false and fussy. and yet she pitied the girl for being stuck with a mother like her. She pinched one corner of the bulletin backing between stained finger and thumb and peeled it away, exposing the pocked corkboard underneath. Without checking to see if anyone was around, she ripped the whole thing off and walked out the doors. Chapter 2. The old brown pickup rumbled down the road, kicking up dust that billowed and fanned out with the southerly wind. Kit gunned it over the train tracks to catch some air, one of the few ways folks got their kicks around here. Jumping the tracks and shooting bottles for skeet, watching garbage burn in massive pyres, and drinking a case by the creek until they puked or passed out or both. Usually, Charlie would hoot and make Kit turn around for another go, and again, laughing and jumping at the right moment so that they were, for a moment, suspended in air. But today, she was slit-eyed and sullen. Kit's feelings pinballed from a salty anger that her daughter had gotten herself in trouble, to a guilty knowing that she had done worse in her day, to a darker, unsettled feeling she couldn't quite place. Absently, she floated a hand over and rested it on the seat behind her daughter, not touching, but near. She couldn't read this girl, who looked blankly at the road ahead. Until lately, she had always known what Charlie felt as if the feelings were her own. She felt it in the fibers of her muscle. Over the past year, her daughter had drifted, her behavior unpredictable, her moods illegible. The stitches that had held them together were frayed, splitting with each big fight. If only Charlie knew how lucky she was. A home, a nice school, a room of her own. And yet, wasn't the point to bring her up so she would never know the alternative? Had Kit chosen differently, they could be living on the move. No address, just a different motel every week when they could afford it, crashing at shelters when they couldn't. The musty couches, the sleeping bag cramps, cheap food that didn't spoil, washing the same pair of underwear every night and wearing them damp or just going without. The aching teeth, the shoes that pinched, the constant, scraping hunger. And yet she had protected Charlie from her past, as if even knowing about it could harm her daughter. Charlie slipped off her boot and punched the radio on with her toe. It was tuned to an oldies station, clearest they could get at 40 miles from Houston. The Bee Gees were on, kind of gasping like someone had grabbed onto their nuts. Those wobbling, tortured sounds were the soundtrack of that winter Kit spent with the Crowders, or Crowleys, Crow-something. The memory of her foster mother, an average-bodied woman with great flaps that hung from her arms, serving her four children from a steaming saucepan something warm and good. Chicken and dumplings, maybe. Kit watched as she ladled it out, dividing it evenly between the four bowls, adding some here, taking away there, so that every child got an equally full bowl except Kit. Hers gaped open and empty in front of her. The kids were increasingly older than her by about a year, and freckles pocked their faces like a disease. She watched them eat, blowing each bite and burning their mouths anyway. She pulled a slice of bread from its sleeve and folded it over and ate it like it was a sandwich and not just a bare fragment of a meal. When it was clear she would not be served, she slid off the chair. She was small enough that her feet did not touch the floor, and went to the kitchen. Bracing her feet against the base of the refrigerator, she threw herself back to open the door. She gathered everything she could hold in her arms and had a feast of her own making in the dark of the pantry, a killing of condiments, leftovers in aluminum foil, a black banana. That family had not been cruel to her, had not beaten or punished her like others had. But the pain of being overlooked hurt more than any whipping. As they drove off the farm road onto the rutty dirt path toward home, the whoop-whoop of a siren nearly stopped Kit's heart. She cursed, slowed, and stopped. After all these years, she was still jumpy around police. Do you think Lee's parents called the cops? Charlie asked, looking more thrilled than worried.
Don't be dramatic. It's nothing, Kit snapped, though she wondered the same.
Kit glanced at the rearview mirror and relaxed a little. It was only Caleb. She noticed the purple stippling on her face and licked her thumb and rubbed at the spots on her cheeks, but the stain had set. She gave up and watched him, half wary, half curious. As Officer Caleb Neighbors walked toward the truck, he smoothed back the ridges of his hair, which would have been wavy if he didn't keep it so impeccably trim, and repositioned his hat. He centered his belt buckle, straightened his gig line, and gave a final inspection of his uniform before presenting himself at her window. She hooked a muscular arm over the door and met his eyes with a look intended to cut him off at the pass.
Listen, I don't see the point of all this, she belted out at him. Nobody knows what happened. It's just a schoolyard tussle.
Afternoon, Kit, he said, and tipped the brim of his hat. She humored him with a slight nod.
Kit, did you know your gas cap was missing?
He seemed, just then, to have manufactured a reason for stopping her. She breathed deeper into her lungs as she shook off her earlier concerns that he'd heard, that she'd have someone more imposing to reckon with than Mrs. Fowler.
Yeah, so? Is there a law against missing gas caps or something? Come to think of it,
he laughed, unnerved, and rubbed the back of his neck.
I guess not. It's just, it might be dangerous, was all I was thinking.
Kit took no pleasure in witnessing him flounder. As if seized by a fresh idea, he snapped his fingers and tried another angle, ducked his head to window level.
What's this you say about a schoolyard tussle?
He asked casually.
It's nothing. Forget it, Kit said.
Anything I could help with?
Though Kit was never fully free of suspicion, he had a friendly air.
I stabbed a girl in the face, Charlie interjected with a proud half-smile. It was self-defense.
Kit muzzled her daughter with the palm of her hand.
Can you shut your mouth and let me handle this, please?
Charlie pulled away.
What? You want me to lie to a cop then? Jesus!
Caleb whistled without concealing his horror at this confession. He tipped his hat back to wipe his brow.
Sounds like you can handle yourself, little lady.
Listen, I gotta go. We done here?
Kit had already shifted into gear. He chuckled self-consciously, taking a step back from the door, and opened his mouth as if to speak a thousand words. Then he leaned in just slightly, and she could smell his good soap and the juicy fruit on his breath.
Y'all coming to the cookout Friday?
He asked.
Pastor Tom's cousin is smoking 100 pounds of brisket for 18 hours or something.
Kit shifted in her seat, itching to leave and wishing she were the kind of woman who wanted to stay.
I don't think so, she said.
And as he held his smile against the disappointment, she was sorry to let him down.
Suit yourself, ladies, he said,
tipped his hat, and turned around. As Caleb walked away, Kit recalled the smooth, even curve of his nails, so clean underneath. She glanced at her own, one thumbnail blackish, split down the middle, the rest ragged from gnawing and cruddy underneath, and curled them into her palm. Kit did not like the feeling she got from Caleb. She knew he had a thing for her. That had been clear for a long time. Most guys would hoot from afar or try to hustle her. They were easy to blow off because she knew what she was dealing with. Blunt, horny, shallow. But with Caleb, she had this horrible sense that he wanted her in a different way. In a for keeps way. He was too sensitive and backed off at the slightest rebuff. But he was patient. He had never given up trying as long as she had known him. Once or twice a year, he'd ask her somewhere. Trail rides, bonfires, church functions, in his Caleb way, both gentlemanly and shy. When he approached her, she felt nervous and conflicted.
She didn't deserve the attention of someone so kind and plain-spoken, so different from Manny. What was love if it wasn't violent and confusing, if you weren't a slave to it? She couldn't begin to see how she and Caleb would work together, but his interest reminded her of how lonely she was. She remembered what it felt like to want someone, to settle into him, thread his legs with her own. The long mornings with their noses overlapped, passing the same sweet humid air between them. If only she could keep the part she liked and trim away the rest, she might think about loving a man again. A swell of pain rose up from her ribs and into her throat. Her eyes wet, her neck flushed. Nope, she thought. She willed away her feelings, a little trick she'd devised as a girl, and felt the sadness fade into a sinking numbness, her merciful retreat. Her arms stiffened at the wheel and she drove ahead as Charlie stared out the window, far away. Kit was late for work, but she needed gas. She coasted up to the filling station and parked under the red and blue flat top, always in front and closest to the road, never boxed in, and squirted some gas in the tank and another gallon or so in a greasy red portable just in case. She hadn't racked up much good fortune in these places and avoided them when she could. Charlie lay across the bench seat and pressed her bare feet to the passenger window. I'm going inside to pay, Kit said.
You could offer me something to eat, Charlie said. I'm frickin' starving.
Ah, she's hungry, Kit thought, though she knew food could only go so far in easing Charlie's chronic bitchiness.
I'd take one of those roller dogs if it's nice and hot, Charlie said. I can pay for it.
With what money? Kit said.
I don't know, Charlie said, instantly sour. I thought I should at least offer, but now I take it back, Christ.
She stretched her legs up to the ceiling and pushed its dented surface up so it made a wonk and let it dunk back into place. She was tall for her age, a leggier, browner version of her mother, more loosely put together, and she moved like there was plenty of space between her bones. Her fierce, dark brows nearly grew together, giving her a permanently intense expression. She hung her head, her blanket of hair over the edge of the driver's seat, and scowled.
What are you staring at?
Charlie sassed, as if Kit were some ogling creep. Kit wanted to ignore her daughter, or fight her, or scream at her. But she knew she had to be the parent, and that didn't come naturally to her. She had to think before she spoke and decided to take a direct approach. Look, kid, she said. I'm just standing here wondering why you stabbed a girl in the face. Charlie shook her head and looked out the window, neither guilt nor care upon her face.
I can't explain, she said nonchalantly. It just happened.
Did she say anything? Was she pushing you around? Charlie slammed the dash.
What does it matter? God, Mom! She yelled. I did it. It's over.
Kit knew she had to leave it there or risk making things worse between them. From the look in Charlie's eyes, a smoldering determination, she knew she couldn't pry any more from her if she had a crowbar. What the hell am I going to do with you if you're not in school? Kit said, not so much to Charlie, but to herself.
Well, I guess you'll have to figure that out, Charlie mumbled.
Kit breathed and stretched an angry knot between her shoulder blades. All right, as soon as we get something to eat, you're coming with me to Doc's, Kit said. She walked away a little looser for having made a decision and, in case her meaning had been lost, shouted over her shoulder, I'm putting your ass to work. As soon as she walked inside the cramped Quick Mart, an internal countdown gave Kit a minute or less before she would need to bolt out of there. She could reason all she wanted that she was safe, but she still spooked at gas stations. She grabbed a gas cap, two oily dogs hot off the rollers, and a package of Fig Newtons, and went up to pay for them along with her fuel. The cashier,
skinny and ball-eyed, put down his jerky to chew her a "How do you do?"
"Hi, Kenny."
She lay her money on the counter and looked out the glass door at the truck, rehearsing her exit.
"Ain't Charlie supposed to be in school?"
he said, and sorted her change. And by the way he played it real casual, she could guess that he had heard about Charlie and Lee. And if he knew it, soon everybody would know.
"Not today, Kenny," she said, rubbing the fat of her earlobe.
Suddenly, it felt like the temperature rose by 20 degrees. "Can you hurry, please? I'm late for work."
"I just ran out of pennies, hang on,"
he said, and stood up to fish around in his pockets.
"It's just 3 cents I owe you. Should be able to dig it up if you just give me a minute."
A dark feeling came over her. The gasoline fumes, the scrape and ting of the cash register, the subtle flicker of fluorescent light. Her heart beat high in her chest and she began to sweat. She took the food and the change he'd laid down, shouldered the door open, and hustled back to the truck. Chapter 3 Kit and Charlie stamped the dust off their boots on the cheery welcome mat and stepped inside Pecan Hollow Veterinary Clinic, where Kit had worked odd jobs since Charlie was a baby. The front office was about 200 feet square, cluttered with plants and paperwork and nearly every inch of wall space tacked with pictures of Doc Robichaux's patients. Lame horses, mangy dogs, coyote-bitten goats, and hen-pecked chicks, many accompanied by thank-you letters from their owners. The office adjoined a much larger space used for exams, surgeries, and when the time came, euthanasia. Out back, she had a couple of acres with 8 stalls, a riding ring, and a barn for hay, feed, and equipment storage. Animals were as important as people at her clinic. Doc stood just over 5 feet tall, with natural, springy brown curls around a cheerful, chubby face. Though heavy, she was also very nimble and stronger than the average man. In vet school, she had been known for tearing a phone book in half for free drinks. Known to no one by her full name, Clotilde Helene Robichaux, Doc called herself a Creole from West Baton Rouge. Why exactly she ended up in Pecan Hollow, of all places, was unknown. According to her own account, it was divine intervention. Having recently graduated, Doc had asked the powers that be to lead her where she was most needed. She had taken I-10 across the Texas border with nothing but her degree, her car, and the gas that was in it. The tank had gone empty just outside Pecan Hollow, and she had pushed the car a half mile until she made it into town, and seeing her prayer answered, there she stayed. Kit liked to think Doc was a runaway, like her. The people of Pecan Hollow, of course, had spun their own mythology about Doc. There were rumors she had been sent away after a woman she had spurned called up her family in a rage and told them the shameful truth about their Clotilde. Kit didn't put much stock in the rumors, since any woman over 30 who hadn't found a man was deemed a lesbian. But neither did she dismiss them. It simply wasn't her business.
"You're lighter than light,"
Doc said, and pointed to the Felix clock with its wagging tail. 11:30. Darrell Chapman, a tall, thin woman with sun-dried skin and a beautician's cap over her hair, waited at the counter to pick up her cat. When she saw Kit, she scowled like she'd tasted something nasty and shook her head. Kit could imagine Mrs. Chapman biting her tongue so she didn't say what was really on her mind. "You're a better woman than me, Doc. I wouldn't trust her for a second.
Uh-uh. I just hope you don't let her touch the money now. You can be a good Christian without being stupid."
Kit scowled right back.
"Sorry it was Charlie's school," Kit said to Doc. "I'll stay as long as you need me."
Kit hated being late. Not because Doc would be mad, but because she didn't like to take advantage of Doc's kindness. She owed her boss more than she wanted to admit.
Doc had always given her steady work and time off for Charlie whenever she needed it. She had given her a job when most people in town wouldn't leave her, an interloping brown girl, alone with their wallets. Some thought she was a grifter. Others just didn't like the look of her. Most were mad she didn't attend church. The summer after Charlie was born, Kit ran out of money. She spent what little she earned from odd jobs on the mortgage, and the rest went to diapers. She got so hard up one month, she hunted squirrels and nutria, lived on meat mostly, boiled pasta, and what little she could glean from the garden. Hunting to eat wasn't so bad, and Charlie was content to feed from her breast. But she lived in fear of losing the house. She couldn't bear to ask anyone in town for help. And though the temptation was always there, she was determined not to steal. More than once, she had pushed a cart through the aisles of the market, with Charlie in the basket, taking food off the shelf. A box of cereal, a gallon of milk, cans of soup, and bottles of Coke. And thought how easy it would be to slip a few things into her backpack, to push the cart to the register, and once all the food had been tallied, pretend like she had forgotten her money and go home, her backpack full of food. Then one day she saw a help wanted sign at the feed store and went to the vet with Charlie in arm. She told Doc she had no experience and would have to bring her daughter, but would work harder than anyone else. Doc had hired her on the spot. Kit and Charlie washed up while Doc tended to Mrs. Chapman. She handed a sedated tomcat wrapped in a towel over to its owner, who wiped her nose with a tissue.
"There now, not to cry, Miss Chap. He's got time yet. We'll keep him real comfortable, and you just spoil him rotten, okay?"
Doc stuffed another tissue in Mrs. Chapman's pocket as she cradled the drowsy tabby like an infant. She reached into her purse, but Doc stopped her.
"Don't be silly, Shaw. This is no time to worry yourself with that. I'll send you a little invoice and you just take your time. Oh, one more thing."
She rummaged through a drawer and pulled out a pungent sachet tied with a crimson ribbon and a chicken bone. "Just a little charm for you. Put it under your pillow before you go to bed, light a candle, and pray to Saint Lazarus." Mrs. Chapman opened her mouth as if to protest.
"Bah, bah, bah, bah. Just trust me now,"
Doc said, and shooed her away gently. She waited for her to leave before formally greeting Charlie.
"Hello, Charlie. How do, how do?"
She slapped her palms and rubbed them together like she was warming them.
"I'm in trouble, so Kit's forcing me to work,"
Charlie announced, a touch defiant.
"That's good medicine for bad behavior. You're very welcome here."
Doc tucked one thick leg behind the other in a curtsy and bowed her head. Charlie giggled. Doc turned to Kit.
"Could you have a conversation with Warbucks and see if he'll agree to try on some new shoes today? I am having the damnedest time with him."
A dimpled smile broke across her broad face.
"Pretty please."
Kit wouldn't admit it out loud, but it felt good to make Doc happy. She nodded and clucked Charlie toward the door.
"Come on."
The stable was out back, a dusty riding ring, and a pasture thick with dandelion and buttercup. As if on cue, a swaggering buckskin stallion stepped out from behind the building into full view. He had strong legs and a shaggy black mane. His neck arched as if he was posing. He snorted and whickered a taunt. Kit approached him and he waited, still but tense. Then pivoted on his back legs, shying playfully away from her. She eased toward where he had stopped to mock nibble a clump of ragweed and hid the halter behind her back. He kept eating, even until she was one long step away from him. When she tried to drop the lead rope over his neck, he snorted and lunged diagonally away from her, bucking gleefully. Kit slung the halter down and walked away from it. Charlie straddled an overturned barrel, laughing.
"Man,
she said.
Your attitude sucks.
Excuse me? Kit took a step toward Charlie, head cocked.
Why would he want to stop what he's doing and hang out with you? You're all wound up.
She swizzled her finger in the air like a spring.
You can't care so much about catching him.
At that, Charlie took a coarse bouquet of alfalfa, stuffed it in her back pocket, and slung the halter over her shoulder. She walked to the center of the ring so he could see her and bent down to tie her shoe, the alfalfa wagging like a tail. She picked up a dirty water bucket and dumped it out, then walked into the stall, never once looking in his direction. There, she began to fluff the sawdust, refresh his water, and scooped molasses oats in his feed bucket. Warbucks watched for a minute, then, with no self-consciousness, walked in the stall and nudged Charlie in the small of her back. She ignored him. He nudged harder, almost knocking her forward. She turned and scrubbed his blaze with her knuckles. She held a halter under his nose and let him sniff it and grip it with his rubbery lips, then slipped it over his head and fastened it loosely behind the jaw. She handed the lead rope to Kit. Kit watched with a mixture of appreciation and resentment. She hated how easily Charlie drew Warbucks in and how smug she looked. Kit winced on the inside to be shown up by her daughter, whom she had worked so hard to shield from her weaknesses. In truth, she had never been comfortable around horses. A decade of working around them had not made it any easier. She could ride a little, had had to over the years, but not for pleasure. Maybe it was because there was no controlling a horse. You had to relate to it. Maybe it was the fear in them, the twitchy ears, the panicked eyes, the tremble under the skin, the unpredictable switch and sway of those deadly haunches. Maybe it wasn't their fear, but her own.
That's good, Charlie, Kit said casually, careful not to give herself away. Looks like you just found yourself a job. From now on, you're in charge of the stable.
She handed Charlie a shit-covered shovel. You clean out the stalls and find me when you're done. Doc stood by the sink washing, foamy up to her elbows. She whistled Camp Town Races and stamped a wide, Birkenstocked foot in time. One of many things she did that made Kit mental. She turned and smiled at Kit.
Charlie sure is getting tall. Taller than you, by the looks of it. How old is she now, 15?
13. Kit said. Doc whistled.
Hoo-wee! What have you been feeding her? Can you get me some?
Doc wheezed out a laugh. More seriously, she said,
it's too bad, though. I wish they could stay kids a little longer. Seems like they see too much before they're ready.
Kit met her gentle, olive eyes for a second.
What about you? Doc asked. What were you like at her age?
Kit bristled at the probe. She looked out the window at her daughter, whose long legs and slender build belonged to the girl's father. She moved like water. Like him, too, she had drills for eyes. Kit, by contrast, was built for work. She was low to the ground, her muscles tensely strung around a solid frame. She was not pretty, but she didn't mind the way she looked. Her clear skin, the warm brown of pecans. She was grateful to be small-chested and had never worn a bra. Nothing on her body hindered free movement.
A foot shorter, a hair meaner, and a lot dumber, she said, hoping to water down Doc's need to pry.
Doc chuckled and shook her head.
Must have been pretty rough, Walker, whatever it was.
She could feel the question hiding in her tone.
Where you come from, Walker? What happened to you?
This wasn't the first time Doc had wondered about her. She had been the subject of plenty of speculation among the people in town when she first arrived. Some said she was the bastard granddaughter of Aunt Eleanor. Others said she had been a prostitute and not to trust her around their husbands.
Kit didn't know what she could tell Doc that wouldn't spark more questions. Easier to shut her down. Don't bother, old woman. Nothing to tell.
Bon!
Doc laughed, rinsed and dried her baseball mitt hands.
You're as thorny as a thistle, but you're good inside. I see you there, Walker.
Kit's skin goosed at her sincerity.
You mind your business, and I'll return the favor, she said.
Doc shut up, but her silence was as conspicuous as a horn. Outside, Charlie shoveled manure into a wheelbarrow, stopping liberally to rest and turn sunward. Out of school, she felt loose and free. The confines of the classroom, its garish decorations and fluorescent lighting, made her dizzy. 20 kids to a class, the stupid chatter, the teacher calling for attention. The best part of school was the 50-minute period of enforced silence during an exam. She heaved the shovel into the soft pile and leveraged its handle over her thigh, then swung and deposited her load. She had not meant to stab the stupid bitch. Put her in her place, yes. Pierce her cheek with a number two? No. That had been an accident. Though she still thought Lee Prentice had had it coming. A lifetime of teasing had given Charlie a thick hide, or so she liked to think. But she wasn't normally one of those kids that fought for attention. If anything, she had tried to lay low. Growing up in Pecan Hollow, with a batshit mom and no dad, was bad enough. But being that way and not attending church made people suspicious. The town was full of characters, but most went to church, every Sunday, whether the sun shone or rain fell. It was the only requirement of country living. Trouble started when Charlie caught Lee copying off her test. Cheating in and of itself didn't bother Charlie. It was the hypocrisy. Lee was supposed to be a big Christian, and to prove it, she carried the good book, with its ruffled and monogrammed Bible cozy, hugged to her chest like a teddy bear. While Charlie was trying to take the test, the girl kept leaning in, closer and closer. Charlie hissed a warning, but Lee looked at her primly and jotted down an answer, then leaned in again for another look. She backed away from the tickle of Lee's frizzy hair and smelled a waft of her cat breath. Something about the stink pushed her over the edge. She went hot with claustrophobic anger and jabbed left to push the girl away. There was a hollow pop, and Lee's eyes widened, her brows arched high on her forehead, lips forming an O. Charlie left the pencil in her cheek and laughed out of shock, focusing on the strange expression and not the horrible thing she had done. Once the teacher, Mrs. Blaine, saw what had happened, she came running and flapped her hands a bit before sending a student to fetch the nurse. She looked around and asked who had done this. Lee, mute from shock, pointed a pudgy, shaking finger at Charlie. She was sorry to have hurt Lee. If she had been thinking clearly, instead of jabbing her, she would have leaned over and whispered, "I just wrote down all the wrong answers," to fuck with her. Or, to be more to the point, Charlie might have said, "Brush your fucking teeth, you cheating stink mouth bitch." Their classmates had encircled Lee, who was screaming and bleeding, and Charlie was stung with jealousy. She couldn't help wishing for some of that concern given so easily to Lee. She thought of the times when she had been pushed around by kids in the hall, how the other kids turned away, how the teachers pretended not to see. Earlier that spring, she had tried out for the track team and had cleared a set of hurdles as part of the agility test. When she came around the bend for the second set, Nancy Sprenger, who was a few paces ahead of her, dropped a hurdle right in her path. Charlie tripped and went sprawling forward. She lay there reeling from the pain in her nose, blood in her mouth, on her face, in her hair. The top layer of skin on her hands had been sanded off on the dirt track. She could tell by the way people covered their mouths and looked at each other that they'd seen what happened. The coach had jogged over and slapped her on the back.
"You're good, right?"
she had said.
"How about you go on and hit the showers?"
She hadn't offered Charlie a hand or sent her to the nurse. Just had everyone take an easy lap and carried on with tryouts. Charlie held her palms to the light. The scars had faded almost completely, as if it had never happened. Some might say she was lucky, but she wanted something to show for her pain. She lifted the wheelbarrow and guided it to a steaming compost pile of manure and kitchen scraps, grass clippings, and old times picayunes that Doc had delivered special. For 20 minutes, she mucked the stalls and dumped the manure, running through a cycle of getting angry and cooling off. Just as she finished her fourth stall, someone cleared his throat behind her. A guy with a straw hat and no shirt leaned on the fence a few feet away. He smiled at her. She brandished her shit-covered shovel at him.
"What do you want?"
He tipped his hat up to reveal more of his face. He looked high school aged, was linebacker fat, chubby but with lots of muscle and thick bone underneath, and led with his chin.
"Well, I sure don't want a busted face," he said, holding up a hand to block her. "Put that shovel down, man, goddamn."
She kept the shovel where it was.
"What are you doing looking at me like that?"
she scolded. He laughed.
"You just look so happy with your face turned up at the sun. I was just wondering what you were thinking about."
"I was thinking about how I punched a hole through some girl's cheek with a pencil."
She felt a satisfaction that this was, in fact, what she had been thinking about and hoped to impress on him that she was not to be messed with.
"You're serious, aren't you?"
he said, looking delighted. Charlie planted the shovel at her side.
"Damn,"
he drawled.
"Well, I guess she must have deserved it."
"Yeah,"
Charlie said.
"She did. She was all up in my business. Kind of like you are now."
The boy laughed again, unaffected in a way that irked Charlie.
"Okay, I can take a hint. Not welcome. I'll be on my way."
He waved goodbye and walked away. Charlie felt a tug and was sorry to see him go.
"Wait, what's your name, perv?" "I'm Jim Durkin, but they call me Dirk."
He waited for her to offer her name, but she hesitated.
"You're Charlie, right? Kit Walker's kid?"
Charlie tensed, expecting him to tease her. She nodded, not convinced a latent attack wouldn't follow.
"Cool. I'm surprised we never met till now," he said. "I like to know the misfits."
She didn't know what that meant exactly, but she had a feeling it meant wild things. She liked that.
"She is kind of creepy, though, your mom."
"There it is," Charlie thought. He went on.
"I never seen such a dark look. It's too bad, because she could be pretty if she didn't always look like she wanted to kill you." "You could, too."
Charlie flushed, embarrassed and disappointed.
"Please don't talk about my mom and me being pretty in the same breath."
"You don't have many friends, do you?"
he said.
"I don't care to have any,"
she said, her arms basted across her chest.
"Well, that's silly. Everyone needs a friend. I'll be your friend if you like."
Now she felt embarrassed for him. He was so out there with his feelings, just open for attack.
"I don't even know what the fuck to say to that," she said.
Dirk kind of sighed and splayed his hands out like he'd done what he could.
"I'll leave you to it, Charlie," he said. "Looks like you got work to do."
He turned and disappeared behind a bend in the road. She felt stupid, like she'd said too much and too little at the same time. Just then, she heard her mother behind her.
"Who was that?"
Charlie got flustered. Her thoughts tumbled around and her embarrassment was beginning to show on her face. but she didn't want to let it show. She took hold of the shovel as if to anchor herself and mumbled over her shoulder,
"Just some asshole."
Kit and Charlie came home from docks hungry and tired. Kit opened a can of Frank's and beans, dumped it in a pot, and struck a match to light the hiss of gas below it. She unscrewed a jar of pickles to eat while supper warmed up. The two leaned against the kitchen sink, passing the jar back and forth, content to snack in silence. The troubles of the day had retreated with the heat, and what remained was the subdued peace of a hard day's work and nothing left to say. Kit fished out the last pickle and thought back to Caleb. He really did seem to always be around her. She admitted he was a man who looked good to her. The cream of his skin and his even build suggested a life clean from too much drink and drugs and other things that wore on a body. He was meant for something better, she guessed, than being loyal shepherd to this town of thankless and errant sheep. She remembered seeing him one winter bringing a drunk to the truck's top for a hot cup of coffee and pie. Caleb sat with the old man and let him talk nonsense while he sobered up. At the time, she had thought him foolish, knowing the drunk might never remember the gesture. It wouldn't stop him from drinking. If anything, he might take advantage of the kindness. She was reluctant to admit Caleb's willingness to sit with a stranger might be admirable. It was harder still to admit that she might want him to sit across from her, nodding and listening and caring about what she had to say. Just then, Kit heard the sound of a big-ass engine growling up toward her house, and Charlie hollered from the living room,
"Incoming!"
She went to the window and saw the Prentice's black Suburban parked askew. The passenger door swung open and Sugar Faye slipped out. She smoothed her skirt and staked one stilettoed foot in front of the other across the drive and up the steps. Lee climbed out the back seat and followed her mother, an ice cream drumstick in hand. Kit went to the door.
"Yoo-hoo!"
Sugar called out over her furious knocking. Kit readied herself for a talking to and opened the door. Sugar looked like she had left the house fully made up but had gotten stuck in a windstorm, the big golden poof of her hair mussed on one side, a little mascara under her eyes. She wore a spring green dress, belted at the waist, a thin black line between the masses of her bust and hips. Her lace slip peeked out below her hem. Lee, whose cheek was padded with gauze, hovered behind her, picking peanuts off the chocolate cap of her drumstick and tossing them aside. Sugar Faye shifted slightly, protectively, in front of her daughter.
"Listen, Kit, I got a bone to pick with you,"
Sugar Faye said in a tone that was both indignant and vulnerable.
"We just left the emergency room."
She paused for Kit, who had nothing, at that moment, to say.
"To patch up her cheek, after Charlie maimed it?"
Kit nodded. She wished Sugar would just come out and say what she had to say. "Rat," Kit said. "How's she doing?"
"Well, how would you feel?"
Sugar snapped.
"If actually not that bad," Lee piped up. "I got ice cream."
She held up the melting cone like a torch.
"I just had to pick up a little treat for the patient. Isn't that right, baby?"
Sugar said, squeezing Lee's hand so hard the girl let out a cottony "stop" and tugged her hand back. Sugar continued.
"She was so brave when they were stitching her up, and I was crying like I was the one in pain. But it does hurt when our babies are suffering. It hurts more for us than them, doesn't it? Like a dull knife to your gut, doesn't it, though?"
And as she talked about it, her eyes flashed with angry tears that spoke all the bitter words her lips could not utter. Kit raked back thick handfuls of her short hair, wiped the sweat off her neck with the collar of her shirt. She knew she should apologize for what Charlie had done. At least she was imaginative enough to put herself in Sugar's shoes and knew that if it had been Charlie with the hole-punched face, there would have been hell to pay. Kit was in the unexpected position of feeling sorry for Sugar Fay. She took for granted that she could always turn to violence. If all she could do was blink away her tears and make subtle hints and rub the shine off her pearl earring like Sugar was doing now, she would have given up long ago. Sugar Fay pulled a little jade tube from the purse hanging from her elbow, took the cap off, and applied her pink lipstick. Kit watched the ritual with interest, how she traced her thinner top lip in an M shape twice, going a little outside the natural line of her lip. Then she dragged the lipstick from one corner of her full bottom lip to center, and again on the other side, and fish-smacked her lips. The most striking thing was how she managed to continue talking during the whole procedure.
"Of course I'll always love my baby no matter how she looks,"
Sugar said with a hand over her heart.
"But Lord, look at this!"
She peeled back the bandage on Lee's face to reveal what was, in Kit's opinion, a minor puncture wound with some light swelling. Sugar took a tissue from her glossy black purse and mashed it between her lips, bizarrely removing half of the shimmery pink she had just applied.
"I've been trying to understand what God wanted for us here, because you know I do trust He has a plan for us, and I know I have suffered from vanity, but is it so bad to miss the face she had?"
At this, Sugar pried open her compact to vet her work.
"Don't you think I'm still pretty?"
Lee said.
"Hush it now, Mama's talking,"
Sugar said with a bit more bass than before. She retied Lee's oversized bow, a fresh green that matched Sugar's dress, at the top of Lee's head.
"How's Charlie then?"
Sugar dragged her teeth over her pretty painted lower lip. Boy, did she look pissed. She was gonna keep Kit here until she got what she wanted, and the more she wanted it, the less Kit was willing to let it go.
"She must be feeling awful guilty, huh?"
"She's a little shook up, I guess," Kit said. This seemed to push Sugar within about 2 high-heeled paces of the edge of sanity. She forced a little hyperventilated laugh, shook her head, and blinked.
"You know, Kit, Miss Fowler said the silliest thing after all this happened. She said to me, 'Sugar, it would be within your rights to press charges against the Walkers.'"
She eyed Kit for a reaction.
"Can you believe that?" And I just said, "Kit is a personal friend of mine, and I'm not going to do any such thing when we can handle things civilly, between us."
Kit wasn't going to beg her off. But she had no power, no money. She had to find a way to blow the smoke off Sugar without directly admitting blame. She crossed her bare arms and pinned her hands tight beneath them.
"I was thinking I could come by, do some work for you, maybe. I noticed you had a bunch of brush out by your gate. I could clear it."
It was as close to sorry as she was gonna get. Sugar looked at her in a tired of caring sort of way.
"Aren't you sweet?"
she said, like she was pondering stronger words.
"You know, I got my 4 boys and Rob, too. I'm positively drowning in helping hands. We're all set,"
she said, and wheeled around on one tiny, pointed heel. And as she did, her blonde curls swung away from a mottled brown stain on her shoulder where she'd held her bleeding, sobbing girl. Kit felt sorry for the first time since she'd gotten the call this morning. Sugar wasn't all bad. She was vain and selfish, but she had a good heart. She was good to her kids, helped people out. There was an elderly woman in town named Nell Clover who had outlived her husband and both her grown children. Nell had devoted herself to taking care of them through their various illnesses, and by the time the last one died, there was no money left for her. Sugar had been the first one to start a fundraiser in church, and before long, she had extended Nell an open invitation to stay in her decked-out garage. Over the years, Kit had even wondered about being friends with Sugar, like those unlikely pairings of species, a golden retriever and a bobcat. It wouldn't have taken much effort on Kit's part. But Sugar's eagerness, her chattiness, her beauty, even her generosity, had all been too much. Trying to be friends with her was like driving a Mack truck through a pinhole. She willed herself to apologize, to throw Sugar a rope.
"Hey, Sugar,"
she said, and heard the strain, like even her vocal cords weren't used to making nice. Sugar broke stride ever so slightly, just enough that Kit knew she'd heard her. Then she loaded Lee into their massive Suburban and drove away.